Hey guys, Becky Quick here, and boy do I have a treat for you. I'm back to share a few bonus episodes of Squawk Pod from our annual Ask Warren interview special with the Oracle of Omaha himself, Warren Buffett. We talk succession planning, big bets, election 2020, and so much more. I'm sharing an episode with you now, but be sure to subscribe to Squawk Pod today for even more. And stay subscribed to this feed too, because we'll have more for you in the coming months. But for now, listen in to the Squawk Pod.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today on Squawk Pod, the U.S. has reported its first COVID-19 case of unknown origin. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who used to run the FDA, explains what's next for the United States.
An epidemic isn't inevitable, but we need to start taking concerted actions right now.
And more from the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett's insight on boards, banks, and avoiding corporate disaster.
An ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure.
Plus, how the world's most famous investor finds those Cinderella stories.
It can take a lot longer than you think, but eventually you get to midnight and everything turns to pumpkins and mice.
All that and a few small changes that could make a big difference in your health.
Shaking hands is a barbaric thing to do.
Barbaric?
I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Thursday, February 27th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We're live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
COVID-19, or the coronavirus, has taken over nearly every news outlet's coverage this week, including here at CNBC. Last night, the CDC confirmed the first U.S. coronavirus case of unknown origin, a Northern California patient with no known travel history to affected areas or contact with another case. This could be the first instance of so-called community transmission in the United States. The news broke on the same day that Germany's health minister warned that country is at the beginning of an epidemic, with chains of transmission that can no longer be traced. The virus has now spread to at least 47 countries, and the World Health Organization confirmed that new cases outside of China have surpassed those inside China. In Japan, all schools will be closed through March as cases approach 200. In Iran, with 245 infected and 26 dead, Friday prayers have been canceled. In South Korea, case numbers are over 1,700. Here's Joe with Becky, Andrew, and our guest host this morning, Barry Knapp of Ironsides Economics.
President Trump, as you probably have heard by now, held a news conference last night to reassure the American public and Wall Street that the U.S. government is prepared to respond to an outbreak of the virus. He is appointing Vice President Mike Pence as a point person for the U.S. response. And Eamon Jevers joins us now with more. What do you got?
Yeah, well, look, this appointment of Mike Pence by the president of the United States, the White House had gone back and forth about whether or not they were going to appoint a czar. The president insists this is not a czar position, but Mike Pence's appointment here does elevate the administration's response. And the president was in sort of a delicate position yesterday. He was trying to reassure the public that the United States government is fully prepared for this. But even as his health and medical advisors were suggesting to Americans that they'd better brace for more cases of coronavirus inside the United States, the president had this to say about whether or not the virus is going to spread.
I don't think it's inevitable. I think that we're doing a really good job in terms of maintaining borders, in terms of letting people in terms of checking people. And also, that's one of the reasons I'm here today, getting the word out so people can, they'll know, they're going to know. No, I don't think it's inevitable. I think that there's a chance that it could get worse. There's a chance it could get fairly substantially worse, but nothing's inevitable.
And Joe, the president also reached for other explanations for that 2,000 plus point Dow Jones drop that we've seen in the market this week. Here's my exchange with him on that.
To be clear, the Dow Jones dropped more than 2,000 points this week. Are you suggesting that was overblown? Are financial markets overreacting here?
I think the financial markets are very upset when they look at the Democrat candidate standing on that stage making fools out of themselves. And they say, if we ever have a president like this, and there's always a possibility, it's an election, you know, who knows what happens.
Now, Joe, when I pressed the president, he did acknowledge that the virus played some role in the 2,000-point sell-off that we've seen here. But this is a president who clearly is looking for other explanations for that stock market sell-off, not happy with what he's seen both in the stock market and in terms of the response by some of the people on his own medical and health team. The president sort of walking that fine line here between reassuring the public that everything is under control and trying not to really set off any kind of panic, either in the public generally or in financial markets, Joe.
Yep. And you heard all the scuttlebutt and media sort of even before the president spoke about there are times in a president's tenure with defining moments. And, you know, we don't need to go over the list now. But sure. And the reaction of the administration to those defining moments can mean a lot for the look back at the tenure of a president. So I'm sure there's a lot of sensitivity to that as well. And
yeah,
it is a fine line. And even if it, you know, love Trump, hate Trump, any president put in that position yesterday probably would have been straining to walk that same fine line between trying to reassure the country but not trying to sugarcoat it too much. Tough position to be in.
Yeah, and you talk about the look back to the president's tenure, but these kinds of events can affect the length of the president's tenure.
It certainly
could. I mean, the president has re-election coming up.
Right.
It is not lost on him and his aides in the White House that this, if it sparks any kind of economic ripple effect, if there are accusations that they've dropped the ball or mishandled this and allowed Americans to get sicker than they otherwise would.
Or just a recession.
This could have a problem.
Yes, or just if there's a global slowdown.
Absolutely.
Or a recession and a stock market break that's worse than your garden variety correction. There's a lot of
absolutely.
Scenarios.
So there's an enormous amount at stake for the White House.
All right, Eamon.
For more on the president's response to coronavirus fears, let's bring in our guest, Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He is the former FDA commissioner and CNBC contributor. He also serves on both Pfizer and Illumina's boards. And Scott, it's really good to have you here today.
Thanks.
You. How should we be looking at this? How are you looking at this?
Well, I think we're entering a new phase. I think we're going to have community transmission in the United States. We already do. There's probably cases in major cities, dozens, maybe hundreds, certainly not thousands at this point, or we'd be seeing that. But the California case demonstrates that there's community transmission. An epidemic isn't inevitable, but we need to start taking concerted actions right now. We need to crash development of therapeutics and a vaccine. We need to dramatically broaden screening. And people need to start getting prudent. Simple changes in behavior can have a very big impact when distributed over a large population. Hand washing, staying home when you're sick, workplaces changing practices. We might need to start engaging in broader mitigation steps to, you know, engage in social distancing and other things like that.
When you say workplaces changing, what do they need to do?
Well, I think you need to start thinking about flexibility for employees. If employees are sick, how they can stay home, how you can support employees with things like daycare and other things that can keep them out of the workplace if they're sick. We need to start thinking about if we're going to have to change practices to limit social contact, cancel large meetings, limit travel. We're not there yet, but those are the kinds of things that you would need to do to prevent an epidemic spread. We will have outbreaks here in the United States. It's inevitable, but we do not need to have an epidemic here. We can't avoid that.
When you sat down at the table, you pulled Purell out of your pocket and actually did this to your hands. What does that do in terms of improving your chances of not getting sick?
Well, look, I think a lot of the transfer, people worry about aerosol, but there's a certain amount of things that we can't do to prevent that. I think a lot of the transfer of this is probably touching and in touching your face.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you're on a plane, it's not the air on the plane. It's someone passing out cups on the plane to all the airline passengers.
But I thought that Purell didn't kill viruses. It killed bacteria.
It kills the viruses. This is a coronavirus. It appears that this virus lives on surfaces for a period of time, but it's not a hardy virus. So alcohol wipes, Lysol.
I've been saying shaking hands is a barbaric thing to do.
Yeah. Are you doing that right now? Are you shaking hands with anybody? Or
I've been trying to avoid it.
You don't agree?
I don't agree with using the word barbaric. I think that at a point like this, it's a good idea not to. But I think if you weren't worried about it, it's a human thing to do to look someone in the eye and shake their hand. I don't think it's barbaric.
But right now
that's all I'm saying. Barbaric? What is that?
There was a study that showed that a fist bump cut transfer by 90%.
Yes.
All right. What about the fist bump?
then.
Yeah, that's right. What you said. 90,
oh, fist bump.
Cuts
okay,
it by 90%.
Because there's no germs here?
It can cut transmission. In all seriousness, I think the backstop, we have to prepare that this is not something that's going to start and stop. This could become something that we have to live with. And what's going to inevitably be a backstop against it is going to be a therapeutic or a vaccine. We need to invest very heavily in that
Scott,
right now.
Scott, we might have a therapeutic already, theoretically. We're not going to have a vaccine for at least a year and a half.
A vaccine's a long way off.
So why not focus on something that lessens the severity of
right,
the...
Right, and remdesivir looks promising, and it could be here...
Is that a Gilead drug?
That's Gilead, and also an antibody-based prophylaxis like what Regeneron's working on. Those things could be nearer-term opportunities, something we maybe even could have in the late fall or early winter.
Well, therapeutically, what about a protease inhibitor? We have stuff already that might...
Those look less efficacious in the in vitro studies. We haven't done good clinical studies with them yet. But I think we need a moonshot approach right now. We have the ability to conquer this with science. The science is there. It's available. Regeneron was able to develop prophylactic antibodies to Ebola, and they had one in the lab for MERS. These things are obtainable,
and that's what
we should be
focused
on.
Isn't it?
It's not a year and a half.
It's not for phase one and phase two?
With H1N1, the swine flu in 2009, the first case was identified, I think, April 15, 2009. Yep. By September, we had a vaccine.
Okay.
This is possible, and that's what we
need
to focus on.
How much money? We're almost out of time, but how much money that costs?
I think we should put billions of dollars. This is not the time to be a fiscal conservative.
Okay. Where are you on the question of the weather, the time of year, whether this dies out when we get the warmer
summer? The summer should be a backstop, but it might not stop transfer entirely because this is a very novel virus where we don't have cross immunity. It should be a backstop. So you could see this dissipate in the summer and then come back in the fall, but by the fall we'll have a therapeutic hope.
Yeah, no, I've seen lots of questions on either side. But
Dr. Gottlieb, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Great to see you. The outbreak is also taking a toll on companies. HP's bottom line will take a hit this quarter because of the virus. CEO Enrique Lores telling Jim Cramer last night that the impact will be felt most in the company's manufacturing business.
As of today, majority of the factories are open, but the production is not at 100% level. From a demand perspective, we don't see any impact. It's all a supply chain-driven impact.
That's for the word.
We calculated and we have estimated that in Q2, this will have an 8 cents impact in EPS.
In a related story, Microsoft says that it does not expect to meet its quarterly revenue guidance for the segment that includes Windows. It's blaming a slower return to normal after coronavirus supply disruptions. Microsoft generates most of its Windows revenue by selling licenses to device makers, including HP, whose sales have been disrupted by the outbreak. And then shares of Nutanix are plummeting. The cloud storage and networking software company cited the coronavirus as one reason for lowering its 2020 outlook. It's taking a more cautious view on the Asia-Pacific and Japan region, where it generates more than 20% of its revenue.
Let's get to the guy with the thick green tie.
Okay. Airbnb is out with a statement on the outbreak, saying that extenuating circumstances, its policy allows guests and hosts to cancel reservations with no penalties. It's reminding people of this policy. The company says it is working to support the hosts, guests, employees, and communities. It believes that the travel industry will bounce back in the long run. Meantime, JetBlue became the first U.S. carrier to cut fees for changing or canceling flights for passengers concerned about the outbreak.
I have a question.
You have a question?
Yeah, when Airbnb says we can do it without fees, who does that pen? I mean, it's the homeowners who are the ones taking that on the chin, right? Because the fees would be paid to them, I would assume, if you cancel. Maybe I'm wrong, but
if you cancel, the fees get partially shared
with the homeowner who you canceled on, who will no longer get the revenue.
Exactly.
Dave Evans points out in my ear, the homeowners can also cancel and say, forget it, I don't want somebody coming into my house.
Right, that's possible too. And therefore, I don't know, does a fee go to the
guest? Person who you just, I don't know.
We'll dig into that.
Barry Knapp is here. Barry, watching some of these moves, you can get a little bit of whiplash.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating, ugly week. But the thing that struck me as I was driving in, listening to Dominic and your headlines, that this is the worst week since October of the global financial crisis. And, you know, when it just got me thinking about, first of all, I had a front row seat for that as a managing director at Lehman Brothers. But this,
you almost caused it, but.
Yeah. Okay. We have a long talk about that one.
I'm kidding. But, yeah, but it's just funny. When you say I had a front row seat at Lehman Brothers, it's like, yeah, you did.
I did have a front row seat, for sure. But the thing that started to occur to me, you know, when I was hearing more discussion about central bank reaction functions and easing policy and the like. If you recall, going into the global financial crisis, household debt was at its highest levels ever recorded in this country. And the mechanism by which you resolve that is largely household refinancing or mortgage refinancing. That's the single biggest financial obligation that most households have.
And rates are at record lows.
But you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
There was actually no mortgage credit available. And that's why Fed policy was so ineffective during the crisis, because that mortgage credit channel was clogged.
But this is different.
It's not clogged.
Yeah.
It's far from clogged, right? We're already running refis at 160% above where they were a year ago, before we even had this last, you know, 30 basis point leg lower in mortgage rates. And by the way, household obligations as a percent of disposable income are at their all-time low. That's going to go down even further. So the household sector is going to be absolutely flush. They've been deleveraging through this whole business cycle. It's only the second cycle since World War II where that happened. It happened in the 60s as well. Mm-hmm. So getting a reaction, you can get a confidence shock in the household sector, to be sure. You've seen some indication of that from Morning Consult, who does great confidence work. It did finally take a hit this week, but it's likely to be temporary. And then if you think about the business confidence channel and just compare it to what happened a year ago, going into the trade wars, business confidence was at multi-decade highs because of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So the impact on business confidence and production was pretty profound from the trade war. Now it was at its lowest level since 2016. So the delta change of that is likely to be much smaller. Furthermore, from a supply chain disruption perspective, I suspect that this will be less disruptive than the great East Japan earthquake and tsunami that shut down the auto industry for 4 months and then was quickly followed by the Thai floods that shut down parts of the semiconductor and electronics industry for another couple of months.
Interesting.
That was also a warning shot to companies. Your interview with Honeywell's CEO at Davos this year, he said, we locally source.
Right.
We produce where final demand is. 11 was the inflection point for that. The trade war further, you know, pushed that agenda. So I just don't see the supply chain disruption as likely to be as big as those. The confidence channel doesn't look as vulnerable. So, yeah, this is a, you know, clearly going to have a hit. But if you think about then the knock on effects from what happened during the financial crisis, the second order effects, I don't see them as likely to be anything like that. Mm-hmm. So we should stabilize.
All right. Cheese will be next.
Coming up, Warren Buffett, insight and ideas from the Berkshire Hathaway chairman and CEO on corporate leadership from the boardroom to times of scandal.
You absolutely have to attack a problem as soon as it occurs and you know about it. And if that had happened, Wells Fargo shareholders would be a lot better off.
Squawk Pod will be right back.
Track Alpha.
You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC.
Up track.
Berkshire Hathaway Chairman and CEO Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, joined Squawk Box earlier this week for a three-hour special we call Ask Warren. You can find a special hour-long episode as well as more great content from that interview in your feed for this podcast. Among the topics covered in this vast but really fascinating conversation was corporate board diversity, which was also a topic featured in Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholder letter. Buffett said that women having a voice in the boardroom continues to be a work in progress. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I read the letter like everybody else over the weekend and was fascinated by so many of your comments, Warren. Specifically, I wanted to ask you, you talk about diversity on boards in this letter. And one of the things I wanted you to weigh in on, if you could, is I don't know if you saw, but David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, on our air actually announced a couple weeks ago that he won't be taking any companies public, Goldman won't, unless they have at least one diverse board member and are likely going to push that to two.
I come from a position of my own experience where I look at the Goldman Sachs board. We have four women out of 11. We have a black lead director. And I really value the diverse perspectives, you know, I'm getting, which are helping me run the company. Starting on July 1st, in the U.S. and Europe, we're not going to take a company public unless there's at least one diverse board candidate with a focus on women. And we're going to move toward 2021 requesting two. And we realize that this is a small step, but it's a step in a direction of saying, you know what, we think this is right. We think it's the right advice.
You know, in the state of California, they put a law into place saying that you needed to have a female board member. And I'm curious what you think of not just the push towards more diversity on boards, but the requirement, because I also note in your letter that you have very specific thoughts about what it means to be a board member, what it means to be an independent board member, how wealth is involved in all of that. What are your thoughts?
Well, at Berkshire, for decades, we've given the three factors in addition to integrity, but for board membership, and we want people who are business savvy. We want them to have a strong personal interest in Berkshire itself, and we've got directors who really represent shareholders basically at Berkshire, and I think they do a great job. Now that doesn't mean that they don't think that we should delight our customers, that we should treat associates well, that we should behave well in our community, both local and national. But our directors represent the shareholders.
So Warren, just to follow up on it though, what's your thought about both the requirement that maybe banks and others, investors are going to force companies to have diverse candidates on their board, laws, as I mentioned, in California?
Yeah, there's been sent to us a proposal, which, unless it's withdrawn, will be on our proxy. I can't tell you precisely what it says, but that relates to this issue, and we will get our shareholders' view on it. I want directors that represent the shareholders, and you know, in terms of my estate, with maybe currently $80 billion worth of shares to give to philanthropy, I hope that we have a group right. of directors that I think will be very conscious of doing the right thing.
The reason I ask the question is because the other point you made, which I think is a very smart one and is often misconstrued in the corporate governance land, is that an independent director these days isn't always independent in large part. And you make the point that those that don't come to the table with some form of wealth often need the job. They need the money. They want the money. And therefore, that makes them less independent. And the reason I ask this is one of the things, as we've been trying to get more diverse candidates on boards, more women on boards, as you know, there are fewer CEOs, fewer people who have made enormous amounts of money, and people therefore then can question their independence. It becomes a very tricky issue, and that's what I was hoping you might weigh in on.
Yeah, Andrew, I've been on 21 publicly owned boards of publicly owned companies, and I've seen them in operation, and I would say that people that I have often seen, and that's perfectly understandable, I have often seen people who are classified as independent directors, and they are getting $300,000 a year for a job that takes them a couple of days, maybe six times a year, maybe four times a year, and the company flies them to their office, and it's very enjoyable, and the company's good, who wouldn't want a job like that? I mean, it's an incredible job. And people, I get calls from headhunters, I get calls from CEOs, and they ask, you know, who I think would make a, quote, good, end quote, director. And what they are asking is, you know, who is not going to cause too much trouble and who is going to reflect, who their name is going to reflect credit on the institution. And they are not looking for somebody that I would regard as really independent, and I don't blame them. I mean, if I had spent my life being a teacher or whatever it might be, I mean, my IQ is just as high as the average or higher than the people on the boards and all that. But on the other hand, I want to get on a board. I mean, $300,000 a year would look terrific, and you don't even have to retire. Probably in most cases, at 65 or anything of the sort. So to call them independent is ridiculous. If you're on one board like that, you want to really go on another one and make $600,000 a year, and you are not going to do things that irritate your present CEO. So when he or she gets a call and says, "Would this guy make a good director?" that the answer is no. I mean, it's just ridiculous to ignore the factor of compensation with board members.
A lot of people had questions about the banks, about what's happening with the banks, what you've changed with some of your investments over time. Jason Goldberg writes in. He says, please ask Warren about his views on the bank stocks in general and on Wells Fargo in particular. Over the last two quarters, he sold almost a quarter of his longstanding Wells Fargo stake. Also in the fourth quarter, he dumped a third of his Goldman Sachs shares, although he still owns over $75 billion in bank equity.
Banking is a good business if you don't do dumb things on the asset side. I mean, basically. And it's a business that the banks we own earn between the commercial banks earn between 12% and 16% or so on net tangible assets. That's a good business. It's a fantastic business against the long-term bond, you know, at 2%. If you have a choice between a 2% instrument and a 12% instrument, which one's going to win over time? So if you ask me whether I think banks are going to go down where they only earn 3 or 4% on tangible assets, I don't think that'll happen. The question is really whether they do something massively dumb, I mean, which periodically a number of banks have done. And I feel very good about the banks we own. They're very attractive compared to most other securities I see. And most of them are buying, Bank of America is buying in a lot of stock every year. So our ownership of the Bank of America this year probably will go up 7 or 8% without us spending a dime. I'd like to own any business, any good business, where my ownership just goes up 7 or 8% every year without me spending any money, and on top of it, I get a dividend and so on. They're very attractive, both against interest rates and against or against bonds and against other stocks, in my view.
You say occasionally they do dumb things. Maybe you're talking about Wells Fargo with the scandal that it had. It just settled on Friday with a number of the regulatory institutions that were kind of looking into it, the investigations that were taking place for $3 billion.
Yeah.
Does this mean that they have kind of finally gotten through that and can move forward?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that they paid $3 billion because it was announced. I don't know what else is outstanding. But Wells Fargo's classic in terms of one lesson. My partner, Charlie Munger, he says, whenever we have a problem, you attack it immediately. He says, an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure. And we've seen that time after time. And the interesting thing, I don't know the details at all, but the original thing was a whole bunch of phony accounts. Now, I don't know how, if you open up a couple million phony accounts, you make any money on it at all. I mean, the shareholders didn't make money. People say that,
the incentive structure was set up so that some of the employees didn't make
money. It was the dumbest incentive system you can think. And as soon as you learn, you can devise dumb incentive systems. We've done them ourselves. I mean, you can cause people to do the wrong thing because they will do what they're incented to do. And they had obviously a very dumb incentive system. People started playing it various ways. And the big thing is they ignored it when they found out about it. I mean, you're going to do dumb things in business, and we do them every day, you know. But you absolutely have to attack a problem as soon as it occurs, and you know about it.
Let me ask you a broader question that comes in just on interest rates.
Sure.
And the impact that might have as well. Varun Jain writes in on Facebook, hi, I'm a huge fan and a student of Mr. Buffett. Please ask him, what impact does the zero interest rate environment across places like Japan and Europe have on their banks, whether the business is still good, and does the prolonged low interest rate regime in the United States hurt the prospects of American banks like J.P. Morgan, et cetera?
Generally speaking, but there are a lot of other variables too, but the banks are going to make more money if there are higher rates with a steeper curve. The curve is more important. In other words, the 10-year versus short-term rates may make more difference than the absolute level. But American banks have made very good money with very low interest rates. Around the world, if you look in the UK or Europe or Japan, even lower rates have made it pretty tough for banks. The returns on equity are not as high, and they have to use more leverage to even get the same returns, and I don't like that as well.
You made a point in the letter of saying that you don't know how long these interest rates will last. Right. You and Charlie never try and figure these things out. But we did have St. Louis Fed President Jim Bullard on the program last week, and he said that he expects to see these low interest rates for a long time to come.
We watch financial stability issues and bubble-type issues very carefully. I think the conventional wisdom is that valuations look high, but not at this level of interest rates. And so to the extent you think this level of interest rates is probably the future, which I've been arguing, I think we're okay for now.
That does raise a lot of questions, if that happens, about what this means for the stock market, what that means for banks, what that means for insurance companies, which you touched on in the letter, too.
It's bad for insurance companies, but it's good for stocks.
bad for insurance companies, and what happens to the insurance companies as a result? Are they getting more?
Well,
are some insurance companies kind of pushing out risk?
The ones that really get hurt on it are either life or annuity companies that have promised returns. The property casualty business doesn't promise returns. It still holds money, so it hurts them. But if you promise somebody an annuity that's going to pay them 3 or 4%, and now you find that you're reinvesting your money at 1% or something, you're going to disappear.
Are insurance companies being forced to make riskier and riskier bets?
Well, they shouldn't be. I mean, the answer, if you need to get 3% and you're only getting 1%, the answer is to quit giving 3%. It's not to try and get the one up to 3 and do more dangerous thing. You should always adapt your consumption to your income. You shouldn't try and adjust your income to your consumption. That's a basic principle for individuals, businesses, and everything else. And reaching for yield is really stupid, but it's very human. I mean, and I understand it. And people say, well, I've saved all this money all my life, and now I can only get 1% out. What do I do? And the answer is you learn to live on 1%, unfortunately. And you don't go and listen to some salesman come along and tell you, I've got some magic way to get you 5%.
Do you think, though, that's what should be happening? Do you think that there is more risk taking place in the insurance market as well?
And you see that in what they call leveraged loans and weaker covenants. No, people are reaching for yield. There's no question about that. And that's stupid. And it has consequences over time. But it's very human.
Consequences that could have a big market impact?
Depends how far it goes. Yeah. It's something that the things that get built in slowly, people going crazy in tech companies in the late 1990s, it can take a lot longer than you think. Mm-hmm. But eventually you get to midnight and everything turns to pumpkins and mice.
Chip Crook writes in a note and says it was reported that Boeing was looking for a large cash loan. Were you ever approached about Berkshire loaning the money, kind of like the Goldman Sachs deal from years ago?
I think Boeing's raised about $13 billion, but that's bank-type money. In other words, my memory is that it's maybe 1% plus liability. They're looking for traditional bank loans, and we don't make traditional bank loans.
You also talked in the letter about how Berkshire Hathaway Energy has the ability and the talent to manage big investments, $100 billion and more. I think you wrote, we stand ready and willing and able on such opportunities. California Governor Gavin Newsom asked you at one point to bid on PG&E. Is that such an opportunity?
PG&E, we work with them for decades and been familiar with them, but that doesn't fit Berkshire. But if there were $100 billion of transmission lines or whatever it might be, Berkshire could do it. I mean, and we would love it. That happens to be a very tough thing to do because you cross all these states and everybody says not in my backyard and all that. But there can be huge intelligent investment made in the utility energy area, and no one is better equipped to do it than Berkshire in both talent and resources.
Why does PG&E not fit that bill?
It's too tough. I don't know the answer to it. I mean, rearranging that utility. I know Governor Newsom. I think he's a very, very, very smart guy. And in terms of solving this problem, it's just not easy. You've got so many constituencies, and they're at each other's throats, and there's lots of money involved. And I don't want to be the guy. I don't know how to solve all that.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Pod. Tomorrow, we wrap up our special week of podcast segments with Warren Buffett, the wisdom of the Oracle of Omaha.
You certainly can't predict the market by reading the daily newspaper, that is for sure. And you certainly can't predict the market by listening to me.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod. We are available for free wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a minute, leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice. That helps other listeners find Squawk Pod. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
Clear. Thanks, guys.